Hi, I'm Ed from Highland. Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me. You should support the show like I did. Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Judy Greer gets stopped on the street a lot. Different people, but always the same question. What do I know you from? She's an actor, so there are a lot of different answers. Could be Arrested Development, could be It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, it could be a bunch of different movies.
People won't let you go. They really won't. They won't let you off the hook.
So she's developed a strategy. She calls it fan profiling. She'll explain it later, and she'll even fan profile me. It's Bullseye. Coming up, my conversation with Judy Greer. The reason people might not be able to place her is because for almost all of her career, she hasn't played the lead. She's kind of come to terms with that.
The lead girl in the movie is never really that funny. I mean, she doesn't get all the funny jokes, and she doesn't get to be weird and wacky because she has to be pretty. And when you're the best friend, you know, you can... If I gain 10 pounds, like, whatever, man.
She's written a book of essays. It's called I Don't Know What You Know Me From. Confessions of a Co-Star. Later, I'll sit down with Ishmael Butler. These days, he's in a hip-hop group called Shabazz Palaces. In the 90s, he was a third of Diggable Planets. That group broke through big time with the hit Rebirth of Slick, Cool Like That.
I mean, it was just kind of like being in a whirlwind of realized fantasies, you know?
We'll talk about the birth and death of Diggable Planets and about the incredibly awkward way they got their record deal. They showed up at a record executive's office, and he told them to rap a cappella for 45 minutes. Plus, I'll tell you about the last Hollywood picture Orson Welles directed. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. When she first got out of school, Judy Greer was auditioning for leading parts and not getting them. So she shifted gears. She became a co-star. Turns out she became one of the most successful co-stars in Hollywood. It stands to reason. She's a gifted actress. She's funny. She's beautiful. But she still looks kind of like a real human being you might know in real life. She's been a best friend in a pile of romantic comedies like 27 Dresses and 13 Going on 30. And she's been in dramatic films like The Descendants and Jurassic World. She's been on every kind of TV show from 2 and a Half Men to ER to Arrested Development. On Arrested, she played the memorable role of Kitty Sanchez, an insane administrative assistant bent on driving home any point she makes by showing her boobs. Anyway, I spoke to Greer in 2014 for the release of her memoir, I Don't Know What You Know Me From, Confessions of a Co-Star. The second season of her TV show, Married, on which she stars, premieres this week on FX. Here she is in one of her classic supporting roles, one of her first, actually, as well, in The Wedding Planner. She played best friend to Jennifer Lopez's character, who is professionally successful and, surprise, surprise, unlucky in love.
Font would I use?
You're gonna be a partner!
I gotta get the account first.
Oh, please, Mary, you're totally gonna get the account.
The Greenberg marriage lasted 1 year, 2 months. You win the pot again.
Thank you. How do you do it? I was more than 4 years off.
I Honestly Love You by Olivia Newton-John was their wedding song. Puts them in the 14-month divorce ring.
Speaking of honest love, Jed was asking about you again.
I don't trust a man who gets regular pedicures.
Mary, you haven't been on a date in 2 years.
Your point?
My point is if you're not interested in Jed, there is a handsome Italian man waiting to marry you in the lobby.
Did you talk to him?
Just for a few minutes. He is so adorable.
He's not adorable.
How can you say that?
When we were kids, he followed me around for an entire summer asking me if I had a vagina.
I think that's adorable.
There was a comment. You did a Reddit Ask Me Anything the other day, and there was a comment that I found very charming, which was from just some dude, and it was about, it was in a thread about a bunch of romantic comedies that you had been in. And he just wrote, yeah, I saw all of these movies. My wife made me. Thank you for making them tolerable.
That's awesome.
There is a very specific kind of thing that you have to do when you are acting in one of these movies and you are not the lead, because the best friend is the person that has to set up everything that happens in the entire movie. So you have to both be believable and essentially narrate the film through exposition.
It's so true. And that was a great clip because I knew what you were doing. And I was like, what am I getting out? That she wants to be a partner, that she's close, that she has to nail this wedding so she can be a partner, that she always wins the pool and how long the weddings last, that she doesn't have a boyfriend that one guy likes. Like, it was amazing. I was like, wow, one scene. I really like...
When you started auditioning in L.A. after acting school, what was it like when you started walking into auditions and you weren't auditioning for a play against theater school people?
Right.
You were auditioning for, you know, the lead role in a WB series, and you were there in one of these weird rooms full of spectacularly beautiful television people.
So beautiful. It was weird because they all looked so pretty and they were so skinny and they all seemed really happy and well-adjusted and they never dropped anything and their fly was never open and they never like thought, like I always run into an audition waiting room like I'm going to pee my pants because you're stuck in traffic for so long to get there. Like they never did that. Maybe they didn't go to the bathroom, those girls. I don't know. But it was different in theater school. You know, you're taught to be anything, that actors can be anything, that you can, you know, I played like an 8-year-old boy with AIDS. I played a eunuch. I played like you're just told that you're an old person, you're a young person, you're a cow, like whatever. And so going into these auditions now for the first time and I'm like, I don't look like these girls and we're auditioning for the same roles and I don't really understand where I fit into this.
When did you make that pivot that you describe in the book between trying to be and not being especially successful at being the superstar lead role and all of a sudden working pretty much right away being the co-star?
Yeah. I didn't really make that decision on my own. It kind of gets made for you. You know, you start – when I came here, I just auditioned for everything. I went in for everything that they sent me on. I would audition 5 times a day. I just kept auditioning. And then it's kind of like natural selection. You know, I started getting these certain roles as like the sister, the sidekick, the best friend, the assistant. And then those are the roles that you start getting called in for. And so it kind of just happened to me. And I didn't make a decision to like stop trying to be the lead, but I love working and I love the roles that I get. And they're crowd pleaser roles, you know. People like them and respond to them and it's fun to make people laugh and didn't really bother me that much, but yeah, it just kind of was like a natural, it was very organic.
Did it give you a sense of what you were good at? Because one of the things that's special about the best friend role in a romantic comedy specifically is that it's one of the only roles historically in Hollywood movies where a woman gets to be funny.
Yeah. I mean, thankfully it's changing, you know, with like great women comedians right now, like starring in movies and making television shows. And but yeah, it was kind of true. The lead girl in the movie is never really that funny. I mean, she doesn't get all the funny jokes and she doesn't get to be weird and wacky because she has to be pretty. And when you're the best friend, you know, you can, if I gain 10 pounds, like whatever, man, like no one tells me you look fat, you need to lose weight. I can do whatever I want with my hair. I can do whatever I want with my makeup. Usually my wardrobe is a little more interesting.
You've worked really consistently through your career, which is a pretty remarkable achievement. I mean, yeah. We're looking at 15 years and something coming up on 100 movies and television programs and other acting roles.
Yeah.
And I wonder if when you were relatively early in your career, even though you were working consistently, there was a part of you that didn't want to turn things down.
Yeah, 100%, and that's definitely still the case. I'm always convinced that every job I get will be my last, and I didn't really turn anything down, and I don't actually turn a lot down. I mean, I like working. I love being on set. I love meeting new people, and I kind of think of it as like stopping the momentum. An object in motion stays in motion, and I always sort of think that with my work.
You write a lot about, in the book, you're growing up in the suburbs of Detroit.
Yeah.
And you seem very Midwestern in that you are very hesitant to give yourself credit for anything.
I know, I am.
is that a public-facing issue, or is that also in living inside of you?
I think it's living inside of me. I was always, you know, I was taught not to brag, not to boast, that at any given minute it could all be taken away from me. My mom, who is awesome, she's weird sometimes, the things that she says. I remember she was at my house. This was a few years ago, and I have a cute little house, and I like it, and it's nice. And she was like, "Your house is so cute." And I was like, "Thanks, Mom." And she goes, "I hope you get to keep it." And I was like,
oh, man.
I was Mom. Like, "Mom, I'm doing okay. Like, I didn't get a big mansion. It's small. It's 1,300 square feet. Like, I'm careful about, you know, my mortgage payment is reasonable. Like, I'm okay. It's okay." It's funny. And then I was like, "Oh, that's where I get it from. Like, that at any given minute, it could all be taken away from me."
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the actor Judy Greer. Her book of essays is called "I Don't Know What You Know Me From: Confessions of a Co-Star." Can you give me some idea of what it is like for you when someone comes up to you in the real world and knows you but doesn't know why?
Well, it's not super terrible, but it is definitely time consuming. And that's my only real irritation, comes from the time consuming aspect of it, at least lately, because people won't let you go. They really won't. They won't let you off the hook.
They need to scratch the itch.
They
do. Who is this person that I recognize?
So badly. Like, it's pretty intense sometimes. I was just in Toronto and New York doing stuff for my book, and I was like going through customs. My flight got in from Toronto into Newark at like 9 or 10 p.m. and I'm so tired, and I've been doing press all day and was wearing very uncomfortable shoes. And the guy, the customs agent, held on to my, he was super sweet. His name was Bill. He hung on to my passport and my ticket, my little like customs thing, until I told him stuff that I was in. And I don't really think he wasn't like holding it hostage. He just happened to have it in his hands when he was like, "Well, what are you in? Why do I know you? Why do I know you? What are you in?" And I just wanted to be like, "Oh, please, Bill, please, can I please just..." And he asked for my autograph at the end of it all.
Yeah, so you've done such a variety of projects. I mean, the people who watch Two and a Half Men are, I'm sure, very different from the people who watch The Descendants or It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yes.
Or whatever, and so, or Marmaduke. But I wonder if you could just, as an example, if you could give me, like, if I came up to you, which I might, I would have a hard time not doing it because I'm a fan of yours.
Thank you.
But if I couldn't place exactly why I was a fan of yours, if you might try fan profiling.
I mean, you, I would go Arrested Development, because I just feel like you're like very hip and cool looking, and that would be, I would say you were an original Arrested Development fan.
Well, I stole the pilot screener from the commercial radio station I was interning for.
Yes.
So I was so excited that there was a new show with David Cross.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey Tambor. Let's take a listen to a clip from Arrested Development. So your character, you had a recurring character, a frequently recurring character on Arrested Development named Kitty Sanchez.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the assistant and sometime love interest
of them.
Yes. Especially of George Sr., who yes. owned the company that was the sort of central MacGuffin in the program. And his son, Michael, had a lot of trouble with Kitty because once he, Michael, became head of the company, he discovered that Kitty had a lot of valuable and dangerous information. So she has to be, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And so he fired her.
Mm-hmm.
When she went on spring break to a place called Senior Tadpoles.
Sure.
And now he is trying, in this scene, he is trying to unfire her because he's realized that he's made a terrible mistake.
Can we just make believe that none of this ever happened and just start fresh?
Michael, of course I'll come back. Because I never really left, because we both know that you can't fire people.
Well, I did fire you, and now I'm hiring you back.
You don't have authority over me. They don't have nachos here.
You know what, Kitty? Why don't we forget it? Because I've been trying to be very, very generous to you, and you don't respect me. So I'm firing you, okay? You are fired.
All right, Michael. But I know where things are, and you don't, and you are asking for a whole world of trouble.
If you're threatening me, you're going to be very sorry.
Are you threatening me?
Yeah, that's a threat. I'm threatening you.
Did you hear that, everyone? Michael Bluth is threatening me!
I gotta get out of here.
I'm part of the story. Can't be a part of the story. Can't be a part of the story.
Say goodbye to your company, Michael. And say goodbye to these. Because it's the last time.
That's it.
Oh my God, she's such a freak. I love it.
At the end, she lifts her shirt. Which Michael's not, I mean, he's trying to avoid that.
Yeah.
I actually have some bad news for you.
Oh.
Which is this. You very nearly got it right when you fan profiled me. However,
do you go archer?
I'm an archer man.
All right.
Archer is what I recognize you from, despite the fact that your face does not appear on screen because it's an animated show. Archer's my favorite show on television, and you play this character named Cheryl Tunt.
Yes.
Now known by another name, Charlene.
Charlene.
And she is a billionaire secretary,
mm-hmm.
Now country superstar,
mm-hmm.
Who is really into rough sex.
Yeah.
She's a real situation.
She's a hot mess, that one.
She is.
I believe that my role was not supposed to be on the show. I think it was supposed to be sort of like a one-time thing. And Adam Reed, who is a genius and writes everything and does everything, he said that once we cast you, we wanted to make it more like a beef up the role a little bit more, which is hugely flattering coming from him. And another thing that was different about the pilot is I was always meant to be this like weepy secretary who was always pining for Archer. And so it was really cool to see the shift in my character when they kind of decided to like use me for my strengths, which my penchant for being like a crazy girl.
Let's take a listen to a scene from Archer. So Cheryl, as we mentioned, is a secretary and she is the secretary for Mallory Archer, who is the boss of the spy agency that is at the heart of Archer. And in this scene, she just suggested a code name for a new operation. The code name she suggested is Dick Sledge. And needless to say, her coworkers then ask her why in the name of all things holy she would suggest that name as the code name for a spy operation.
So then it's settled. We're a go on Operation...
Ew, what should we call it?
Dick Sledge.
You wanna...
No, but it's like sour milk. You just gotta take a whiff. What's the story, neckbones?
Sophomore year at my stupid college, I had a huge crush on the quarterback, this super hot guy named Dick Sledge. It was like I was invisible. He wouldn't even sign my cast when I broke my own arm. But I thought, if I knew what he liked, then I'd have an in. So one Saturday when he had a game, I broke into his dorm room to see what kind of music he was into, or turtles, or roll around in his clothes, or whatever. But
you were so busy sniffing his jock, you didn't hear him come in?
Because he totally snuck up on me! Then I guess I blacked out because I don't remember stabbing him at all.
Why'd you have a knife?
I didn't. It was a stupid pair of scissors. And it was his fault for grabbing me with his throwing hand. That's how his tendon got severed. They said he could have gone pro.
So, glossing over why you broke your own arm.
So he'd sign my cast.
That's amazing. I forgot about that.
I had to, and it's great. Do you ever get a script for this television program and think that may be too much?
No. No, I don't.
You have a best friend who eats cocaine, by the way, on the show.
Yeah, in all forms. My favorite is yogurt. I love that they make cocaine yogurt. I love my relationship with Pam because we're a wreck together. Like, we clearly are best friends, but like we can't stand each other also. I don't think we could function without each other. I never think it's too much.
Oh man, I guess I could do an hour just about her new role as a country music superstar.
I know, it's great, she's amazing. And that's like this weird, you know, she now has this like weird trait, this quality that no one knew about her, and that's how they're going to make money. And oh, it's so funny. All of them living in her mansion. So good. Where does he think of these things?
Can we say her new catchphrase together?
Yeah. Should I scream it?
Yeah, we should scream it. We'll scream it.
I'm not moving my microphone because I'll never get it back. Ready?
Outlaw Country! Woo!
Judy, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining me on Bullseye.
So fun. Say goodbye to these.
Judy Greer's new book is called I Don't Know What You Know Me From, Confessions of a Co-Star. The second season of her TV show, Married, starts up this week on FX. After a break, I'll talk to musician Ishmael Butler about Digable Planets and his new hip-hop group, Shabazz Palaces. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Do you need a weekend movie recommendation? Are you still digesting the last episode of your favorite show? NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is good conversation about the very best things to watch, read, and listen to. Find something new to make you happy. Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Find it now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Hi, I'm Lisa Hanawalt.
And I'm Emily Heller. And if you're not listening to our podcast, Baby Geniuses, you're missing out on stuff like...
Kumail Nanjiani solving the Zodiac murders.
Who's like, would you ever go to a friend and you're like, hey, could you lick all these envelopes for me? You'd be like, you're a serial killer. I'm leaving right now.
Guy Branum talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And it was just a great moment of like, oh no, I'm here, boys. Like, I'm on this side of the bench.
Megan Amram talking about intimidating baristas.
Just feel like they're always in character. Like, they're always in character as, like, cool hipster girl. Mm-hmm. And I just want to break through that barrier.
Plus, every week we explore a new Wikipedia page and talk to a crazy expert in the field of nonsense.
Well, any hack can make you not have a boner. I mean, it's about how you do it.
Right.
You
know?
And we're the only podcast with regular updates about Martha Stewart's pony or your money back.
We're not going to give them their money back, are we?
No.
Let's keep it.
Yeah.
Listen to our show every other Monday on Maximum Fun.
Yay!
Yay!
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Ishmael Butler's rap career started with a bang. His group Digable Planets had a crossover hit with Rebirth of Slick Cool Like That, which won them a Grammy in 1993.
We like the breeze float straight out of our lids. Them, they got boo bodies, hard rock Brooklyn kids. Us, Floor Rush, when they DJ booming classics. You dig the crew on the fattest hip-hop record. He touch the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents deep, fatter joints called undergrounds. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, Boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why is it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When Butterfly rocked the light new sway boomers. What by the cut? We push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh in fact since they started saying Audi. Cause funks made fat from right beneath my hood. The pooba of the styles like Miles and shish. Like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock. But I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that.
They were cast as a jazzy, non-threatening alternative to gangster rap, though they weren't that nuts about the role. Their second album was denser, and it replaced innuendo with explicit revolutionary politics. Despite good reviews, it flopped, and Digable Planets broke up not that long thereafter. Then, for 15 years or so, Butler was barely heard from. A band called Cherry Wine came and went in the early 2000s. There were a few feature performances. Then, a couple of years ago, he started a new group, a duo called Shabazz Palaces. A few free EPs led to a deal with the legendary indie label Sub Pop. Now they've put out 4 records in 4 years. Their latest is Les Majesty. Here's a bit of the opening track, Dawn in Luxor. From out the water's wall, from Luxor to heaven's endless sprawl. See the waves crash against the glistening purple cliffs. You're ripping, amazing ship. The ships that came from coast, now they're hanging a collision. You stare with this image, being witness. I'm not using precision in its simplest, simple strength. Precision. Ishmael Butler, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Good to be here, brother.
I was happy to see that. I felt like there was no way for me to start the interview without playing a little bit of Rebirth of Slick, because it's your smash hit record that everybody knows, right? Mm-hmm. And I was worried that if I played it, you would get that kind of look that sometimes musicians get when you play their hit record.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like, oh, I'm sick of this record. But you were right there with it. You were nodding your head to it. You were enjoying it.
Yeah, no, I'm not sick of it at all. I play it every morning before I leave the house.
That's not true.
No, it's not. That's not true.
You're not going to sell me that line. You grew up kind of going back and forth between Seattle and the East Coast, right?
That's true.
When you moved to New York as a young adult, why did you move there?
To be in the rap gang. New York is, at that time, was it's kind of like Mecca. You know, like that was the place that you kind of had to go in order to get on the map in a certain way. All the indie labels were there. Everything was happening there. So it seemed like the right thing to do for what try to fulfill my dream at that time.
Tell me about what it was like to be a guy that was mostly then from Seattle and just like show up in Brooklyn and be like, hey, guys. My name's Ishmael.
Yeah.
I'm from Seattle. I'm a rapper, too.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, looking back, I guess it was daunting, but for me, every day was exciting, you know, and it was such a rich time. I actually got a job working as an intern and kind of a gopher at this label called Sleeping Bag Records, which was like Just Ice, EPMD, Steezo, guys like that. So I was just working in the mailroom, and at that time, like, if you wanted to send some contracts from 43rd Street to some law offices on 59th, you would hand them to somebody, and we'd either walk it up there or ride a bike. So I spent a lot of time out in the street going in and out of independent record labels and law offices and stuff like that. And at night, we would hit the parties and opening parties and record release parties. So, I mean, I was 18, 17 years old, and it was just, for me, like being at, you know, Disneyland or something.
Things were changing in hip-hop so fast at that time. I mean, the difference between a record in 1993 and a record from 1990 is so vast.
Mm.
It must have been an exciting thing to be a part of.
That's interesting. I think the reason that it was changing so fast was because everybody that jumped in the game knew they had to have something new and different in order to be recognized and accepted, because back then commerciality wasn't the main thing. It was you had to be good. So if you weren't, you weren't going to get in. So I think those leaps were happening because cats knew they had to come with some new otherwise you weren't gonna get seen.
Let's listen to a little bit of Diggable Planets and Pacifics.
Butterfly, searching for a relax, pulling from the jazz stacks cause it's Sunday. On the air is incense, sounds to the ceiling, trying to get this feeling since Monday. Looking out the window, watching all the people go, bugging off a funny vibe cause now it seems they're equal. Wonder what would train say, wonder what my pop say, bugging off the calmness in the apple. Who me, I'm cooling in New York, I'm chilling in New York. Is on my block and the brothers at the court. The baseball hats is on and the projects is calm. Dream time's extended
and highly recommended.
But early birds like me's up checking out the scene. The early worm's job, forget about your job. Just come dig the essence while the decadence is hidden. When people act like people, the theory isn't pigeon. If you know the norm, it's like Hades transformed. On Sunday's early hours, the city sprouts its flowers. So get with the rhythms while you get in with the planets. Vibe off the jams, but don't take them for granted. Just chill.
How did the three of you get signed?
There's this cat. Well, there was this guy, Dennis Wheeler. He was A&R at Pendulum. Pendulum was a subsidiary. That's when, like, all the majors would have these independent subsidiaries. Was of Elektra Records. So Dennis got a hold of our demo. We did this demo, and we also shot a film on VHS. And so our demo package was a video, VHS video, and it had the music on it and it had a tape in it. So we presented that to them. He thought it was cool. We really went kind of all out at the time. And he dug it and he presented it to his president of his label, Ruben Rodriguez, who was like a Columbia A&R radio promotions old school cat. And he had got his own label deal through Elektra. So he dug it too. So he brought us up to the office one day and we thought we were just going in for a meeting and to meet him and like kind of hobnob, but we were real bright-eyed. We didn't know what to expect. So we got there and he just like made us perform in his office, you know, for like a performance though, like maybe 40 minutes. So, you know what I mean? So
Were you just going a cappella?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, he just wanted to see, first of all, how we responded to that request, obviously, but also, you know, what kind of presence we had, you know? So we were kind of shook up after that, truth be told, and we didn't think that we fared well. But a couple weeks later, he said that he dug it, and we were going to try to make some moves in terms of getting signed. But then we probably didn't get signed for another year and a half.
Did you think at some point in that year and a half, this is not going to work?
Yes.
Like when I say this is not going to work, not just Diggable Planets, but the whole thing isn't going to work. Like I got to go to college or get a job.
Yeah, for sure. Because I'd left college, you know. So my parents were just like, come on, man, what are you doing? You know, like, and at that time, you know, if you didn't have a record deal, there wasn't no do it yourself or put it up on YouTube or anything like that. I figured it wasn't going to work, sure. But now that I look back on it, I must have had some, maybe it was foolish, but some glimmers of hope and belief in the back of my mind because I kept pursuing it the whole time.
What did the other members of the group think?
Well, the funny thing was that that audition was with the first people that were in the group. So when they finally decided that they wanted to sign Diggable Planets, those guys had already been on their own mission, so I had to go find Knowledge in Mecca, who, in the meantime, I had become who we became to each other. You know what I mean? So fortunately, they were even more capable and much more interested in doing it than the original two. So, you know, it worked out for the best.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Ishmael Butler. He was one third of the hip hop group Diggable Planets. I spoke to Ish last summer, just after Shabazz Palaces released their second album, Less Majesty.
When Rebirth of Slick became the like monstrous epic hit that it was like, if I'm remembering correctly, like top 15 pop or something like that.
I think so.
What was it like to be in that world where you're like on MTV and like flying from place to place and making appearances at malls or whatever?
Yeah. Man, I mean, everything I can think of saying sounds a little cliche. I mean, it was just kind of like being in a whirlwind of realized fantasies, you know? Having so much energy and having so much, such a bright outlook, it seemed like just the ultimate gift being presented and laid out in front of us, you know? Like, I've always been wanderlust, you know, and exploratory and curious, so everything was right down my alley, you know, from traveling and going to different places and staying gone for the better portion of a year. I was really in my element, so it was just magical, man.
You know, I was like middle school age when that record came out, and I remember the way that it was portrayed, the sort of the story that was told about it. And it was, as I alluded in my intro, about this dichotomy between gangster rap, which people were kind of freaking out over at the time, and like, oh, these guys are like jazz guys. How did you guys feel about that at the time?
We didn't rock with that at all. We didn't rock with that at all.
I guess that might be the case.
Yeah, I mean, because we came from the time when, like, it would be like, when I came up, you go to a concert, it would be like the Fat Boys, Houdini, Super Lover C and Casanova Rug, Kumo D. Like, it hadn't got divided yet, you know? Like, we didn't perceive things as being different, you know, like that. Rap was rap. You had to have your own style. It had to represent your environment, the truths about who and what you were. Like, there wasn't this notion that it, rap was one thing, or that it, these categories hadn't really been developed yet. So we were kind of, when that started happening to us, we didn't really rock with that too tough at all. I mean, because all that stuff, N.W.A., Cypress Hill, like we loved that, you know, and we related to it, and so we didn't really want that division, and we didn't really see it as authentic either. We understood it as marketing, and I guess a lot of that was why we understood it and let it slide to a certain extent as well. But I mean, like you said, I mean, on Blowout Cone, we just didn't want there to be any mistake on where we were coming from at the same time, you know?
Let's take a listen to a track from Digable Planet's second album, Blowout Comb. My guest is Ishmael Butler, who was a third of Digable Planet's and is half of Shabazz Palaces. This song is called Ninth Wonder, Blackitalism.
I'm slicker this year, I'm slicker this year. Myrtle Ave, A-Train, got the pick in my head. And what, 16 joints later, still lounge. Fresh, from Flatbush in my baggy boots to guess. Stylish tight jeans, busted Cammy fatigues. 50,000 leagues of black, so we chef. Can we avenue slide, player style, get a walk to the east, sun, wow. Crookland, New York, creamy kick, Dale Smith and Wesson. When the blessing, the angular slang, blow spots, bang, 11. Hanging like bats, the 12-inch wax, say Scorpio. And my hair say fro, and my blood say bro. My click say ayo. Make sparks from the barrel, mento pistol. To the depths I die, seems lunar like aqua. The cool blast mother, we black, we wildflowers. Scott LaRock had them all, I got the ball. And roll a little practice through these project calls. The three color black can't hold my baggy sack. 7182 Omega. Black motion is ocean style. Slick in my way since days of the classic. Now glamour boys wanna be triple fatted, but I'm slicker this year. I'm slicker this year, yeah. Eastbourne,
beast candles. What are you giggling about?
I don't know, it's just funny, like, I sound like so tiny, man, to myself, you know?
It has such a specific sound, that record.
Mm-hmm.
And it is coherent in a way that most, especially hip-hop records, but almost any LP, isn't. Was that intentional?
I hope so. I mean, everything for me at that time, I think, was like Sun Ra, Bitches Brew era, Miles, and Parliament. Yeah, we were thinking like that.
It's funny. I was giving clips to my producer, Julia, and I messed up one of the titles of one of the songs, and I realized that as many times as I've listened to the record, like, I didn't know any of the names of the songs, in part because it almost feels like one song never ends for another song to begin.
Yeah. I always like when people call a song whatever they remember about it rather than what the title is, you know? So, yeah, I mean...
Is that why all your songs have such insanely complicated titles?
Yeah, definitely. Because in the end, people will just be like, they'll come up with it. You and your friends, if you like a song, you always got a name for it that might not have anything to do with whatever the artist wanted it to be.
Let's hear some of Digable Planets and Dial 7, open parentheses, Axioms of Creamy Spies, close parentheses.
Like that, I seen I was the son of all man, type blood, guerrilla fighter, super fruff, busted, the beast may want a war in this summer, thus, I rock my camouflage, playing corners, Kevin sends kites while they pimp hip-hop, I strategize my joints, you know it don't stop, and it don't pop, son, it's P-Jack bound together, for beats and concrete when I'm creamy with my stiletto, got 16 from the imperial fascists, Vaughn Beats brothers and honeys, we bout to set it, domino theory cause they stored our flow. Collecting pitchforks till they free to grind them
up. One of the things that stands out to me about the album is the way that while all three of you are very strong MCs, aesthetically, you let the rapping sit back a little bit further than is typical on a rap record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most rap records are about showcasing a rapper first and foremost, tops, and maybe on the chorus there's also a catchy singer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's about skills or telling people to party.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't what this record was aesthetically.
Yeah, to the credit of the label, they balked about that, about just where the vocals sat in the mix. But I fought about it because I was listening to stuff that the vocals were just another part of the overall sonic wave rather than, like you were saying, you know, this sort of separation between the two. So they let it slide, you know? And I feel like it gave a little longevity to the recordings because over time, if you like it and you listen to it a lot, there's always something discoverable about it because it's all cohesive in a way that it's not separated, where you get that and you get that, you know what it is. Like, it waves and changes. Even me, sometimes I hear different stuff going on.
The vocals have this quality that reminds me of like an early to mid 70s Sly Stone record where, you know, he was like going into the studio and recording vocals over and over and over on the same tape until it was like almost a little bit worn out.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of slides back just a couple of notches.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I was listening to that too as well, a lot of that. I really like that stuff. And also too, man, I mean, you know, that all that stuff was going on too, 2-inch tape through a Neve board. My engineer at the time, this guy Dave Darlington, man, who, you know, is really the mastermind behind interpreting what I would ask him for and being able to deliver it, he could do it. He was a jazz-trained musician, bass player, who got into recording and engineering. So he suggested, you know, you want to do that? Then this is how we're going to record it. This is what we're going to record it on. And that was my guy that made it all happen.
I'll finish my conversation with Ishmael Butler after a break. I'll ask him the question that haunted 13-year-old me and 14-year-old me and 15-year-old me, 16-year-old me, and so on. Why Dickable Planets broke up.
I don't think it was meant to be forever.
It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Thanks for listening to Bullseye. Do you need a weekend movie recommendation? Are you still digesting the last episode of your favorite show? NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is good conversation about the very best things to watch, read, and listen to. Find something new to make you happy. Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Find it now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Bikini season.
Volleyball time.
Hot dogs and hamburgers.
Get ready to Olympic dive.
4th of July.
Are you ready for rollerblading rain time?
That's right. It's Aaron and Brian from Throwing Shade, if you didn't know from that very clear intro.
We take a look at issues involving ladies and gays, and we treat them with much less respect than they deserve. So watch out, punks.
So, hey, download us and take us to the beach while you're doing your summertime fun.
Hey, it's me, Jesse. If you're in L.A. or Southern California, I'm going to be doing my talk, Make Your Thing, about making independent media on Sunday, July 19th at the Annenberg Space for Photography. So go to MaximumFun.org, check out the events sidebar on the right, and you can find all the information. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope I'll see you there. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Ishmael Butler. He was a third of the Grammy-winning hip-hop group Diggable Planets in the 90s. These days, he's pushing the edges of hip-hop with Shabazz Palaces. Their new record is Les Majesty. What broke up the group?
You know, man, it's just like we were 20, you know, 21, 22. Mecca was even younger. Like, in truth, in being candid, like, a lot of the considerations by the label and management and stuff would kind of fall to me because they understood me as being a catalyst or the creative force behind it. And those guys were talented and had their own ideas, you know. That with us being young, and when you're young, just a lot of stuff is short-lived anyway, you know, relationships with girlfriends or boyfriends, like you, who knows who they was dating when they were that age, you know. So I don't think it was meant to be forever. So, you know, and plus we had done so much. We had a good sense of accomplishment, and we realized that, you know, if it's over and it was short-lived, it wasn't like it wasn't fun and good and we had a rich time. So, yeah, a lot of people think it maybe it was one thing or some blow-up thing, but I don't recall anything like that if it was. It just kind of faded away.
Was there a day when everybody got together and said, look, guys, this is settled?
Yeah. We had a dinner with Ruben at a restaurant, and we were all there, and he was asking us, you know, if we were going to do something again, because they had moved to EMI. The blowout cone didn't really do that good, so we were really discussing whether or not we were even going to get the opportunity from the label to do something else, which I think they would have let us do. But, man, we hadn't seen each other. Me and Knowledge always stayed cool, but Mech was off on her own thing. We hadn't seen her for a while, and she was just real aloof and not really there. And she just, I remember her saying, you know, he was like, are y'all going to pursue, you know, this music thing anymore? And she was just like, yeah, we're going to pursue it just individually, you know? So we were just like, man, okay, I guess that's what it is.
You didn't record a lot of music that came out for the next almost 10 years or so.
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't out there, you know, on the boards right away for a bunch of new projects. You weren't out there cutting guest verses on people's songs.
Yeah.
Did you, like, get a job?
Yeah, well.
Or go back to school? Or?
I did go to school. I went to film school at NYU for 2 semesters. And got into, like, a serious relationship, had a son, you know, was just kind of doing that thing. I missed traveling, but I was cool. I wasn't really missing the business like that. So when I was out of it, I didn't feel like, man, I got to get back in it or anything like that. I was just on to other stuff.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Ishmael Butler. He was one-third of the hip-hop group Diggable Planets. These days, he's in a group called Shabazz Palaces. Their latest record is Less Majesty. I spoke to Ishmael last year.
Let's hear from Shabazz Palaces' first LP, Black Up, Free Press and Curl.
Dancing shit in the rain, juicy lips, watching gloves in the sauce. Cried with Mooch at Poppy's wake. Snuck an extra slice of cake. When the pigs came round to make their case, I looked them dead up in their face. I never heard them, none of that. Soon as I win, let's run it back. I run on feelings, off your facts. Deception is the truest act. With poise, I twirl the bluest lack. Dougie hold the oohest sacks. I danced and moved to play the back. I dipped, she asked him, who was that?
I ain't show off, I just showed up. Greet my peoples, fill they cup. Transmit heat on pillows, plush, I mean it though.
Are all the sounds in Shabazz Palaces sounds that are either electronically generated or recorded instruments being played, or are they samples as well? Okay, you don't have to answer that question. That's what that smile means. Do you need to check with your lawyer on this one?
No, there's no samples on here, man. No samples whatsoever, you know? Yeah. Now, we just do a lot of manipulation, man. So, yeah, that's how we get our sound like that, man.
Are you ever in the studio and you want to make a track that just goes like, dung, ka, dung, dung, ka, so you can just spit like crazy? Just spit bars?
Yes. That happens quite a bit. We probably make, for this album, probably made, like, I don't even know, man, like hard drive. Plus, we lost a hard drive with 200 songs on. Like, you got to go through a lot of things to get to certain places. But, yeah, we always make stuff like that, too. And also in the live performance, we do that a lot, too. There's a lot of improvisation. Probably 40% of it is just made up there on the spot.
I want to ask you about Seattle. Mm-hmm. You left Seattle as a teenager to go sort of make your name in New York at a time when hip-hop lived in New York. It's funny to be from a place, you know, when I was last in Seattle, I had this long conversation with somebody. And in fact, it seemed like every conversation I had with somebody like started with My Posse's on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
right? Like the Sir Mix-a-Lot classic.
For sure.
The classic Seattle hip-hop record, right?
Right.
And now one of the biggest hip-hop artists in the country is from Seattle, Macklemore.
Mm.
And it's such an odd pairing of dudes to have be like the national representatives of Seattle hip-hop, right?
Yeah, it is. When I was growing up, Mix-a-Lot, he's from Yesler Terrace. It's like these projects up on Yesler. And at the Boys Club, he used to throw these parties. And it was just like basically a thugged out affair back then. We would go up there and just kick it, and he would DJ and stuff like that. So I have a good context for where Mix came from, Anthony Ray. Much respect for him and what he did. But, that other stuff you were talking about, I don't really know too much about that.
You're shaking your head.
Yeah.
I think he's a pretty talented guy.
Who, Mac?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to sit here, Ishmael, and tell you my favorite rapper of all time is Macklemore.
That's good.
But I'm not going to tell you I think he's garbage.
Yeah.
It's a fun record, his hit record. Ishmael Butler, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on Bulls. That was such an honor to have you on the show.
I appreciate it, man. This is a great thing that you got going, bro. This is real slick. Thank you.
Ishmael Butler is half of Shabazz Palaces. They've got some shows and festival dates across the United States this summer. You can check out ShabazzPalaces.com to find them. S-H-A-B-A-Z-Z Palaces.com. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week, we like to close the show with a recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. There's an amazing shot in Touch of Evil. The movie's a noir, the last thing Hollywood let Orson Welles direct. He plays a cop in a border town, a crooked one. This Mexican detective's onto him, coming after him. We see the detective in this little mirror on the wall of a brothel where Welles is holed up. Anyway, the shot. You see Welles from just below, against the crumbling adobe wall. He was already getting big then. This is the late 50s, but he was also padded out. He looks huge. He's in the bottom right-hand corner of the frame, breathing these big, heavy breaths. He's drunk, just fallen off the wagon. His tie's misplaced. His beard is grown in. And there in the center of the shot is this bullfighting trophy, a huge bull's head framed by the swords that killed it. Touch of Evil is a story about a great bull, honorable in his own way, but savage and terrifying too. A bull getting stuck again and again and fighting through until he can't anymore.
Hank, I've been looking for you in every bar in town.
I've been in half of them, only here on the wrong side of the border. I never drink on my own beat.
Bartender, give him some black coffee, quick.
I don't need coffee. Meeting?
Vargas at his hotel.
The Mexican detective, who, by the way, is played by Charlton Heston with a little bit of makeup and almost no accent, is the good guy. We can see that. But with Welles, it's a little harder to tell.
Come in, Hank.
Well, I don't know whether I'm welcome or not.
I want you to hear this.
I've heard it already.
Our friend Vargas has some very special ideas about police procedure. He seems to think it don't matter whether a killer's hanged or not, so long as we obey the fine print.
Captain, rule books. I don't think a policeman should work like a dog catcher.
No.
Putting criminals behind bars? No. In any free country, a policeman is supposed to enforce the law, and the law protects the guilty as well as the innocent.
Our job is tough enough.
It's supposed to be. It has to be tough. A policeman's job is only easy in a police state. That's the whole point, Captain. Who is the boss, the cop or the law?
Citizen Kane was Welles' first movie. It changed film forever, but it also launched 45 years of pain for Welles. There were a few successes, but mostly there were decades and decades of failed projects, meddling financiers, and would've, could've, and should've beens. The whole thing was his own damn fault, too. Because he was a bull. Even in 1958, when Touch of Evil came out, he was a bull, careening through the world of film, destroying movies, trampling relationships out of anger and hurt, bolting out of the gate and getting stuck through over and over again, till he just collapsed under his own weight. Toward the end of Touch of Evil, Welles is tired. He's lost his cane. He needs it to walk because he once took a bullet for a friend. And he's back in that brothel, trying to get the madam, Marlene Dietrich, to read his fortune. He wants to know if maybe, just maybe, he can pull this one out.
What's my fortune? You've been reading the cards, haven't you?
I've been doing the accounts.
Come on, read my future for me.
You haven't got any.
Hmm? What do you mean?
Your future is all used up. Why don't you go home?
Welles' old gamey leg gives him an intuition. That's what they say in the movie anyway. It hurts when he's onto something, like a trick knee when a storm's coming. And he follows the pain, for good or ill, or for good by way of ill. Maybe the real Welles let his pain lead him too far. I don't know. I'm not a great artist, and Welles was. Maybe Dietrich has it pegged.
He was some kind of a man. What does it matter what you say about people?
Goodbye, Tanner.
Adios.
That's my outshot. That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Senior producer at Maximum Fun is Colin Anderson. Our thanks to the Go team and their label Memphis Industries for their theme music. All our interstitial music is provided by Dan Wally. If you'd like to hear any of our past programs, they're all free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And if you want to hear about more cool culture stuff, you can check out our sister podcast, Pop Rocket. It's a roundtable discussion of everything great in popular culture, hosted by the brilliant and hilarious Guy Branum. This week, the team share their opinions on Rihanna's new and somewhat graphic music video, and they share recommendations for summer reads. Find Pop Rocket at MaximumFun.org or wherever you download podcasts. Just search for Pop Rocket. And do that. It is such a great show. You will really enjoy it, I promise. In fact, how about this? If you don't enjoy it, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope at MaximumFun.org, 2404 Wilshire Boulevard, Unit 9A, Los Angeles, California, 90057. And right at the top, attention Pop Rocket refund. And I will give you not only a full refund of your purchase price, but also an additional 25 cents. Cash. Pop Rocket, you're going to like it. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist-owned.
Listener-supported.